for standing by. Just a reminder that today's call is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Ms. Jones, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. This is Jane Houston Jones. I'm from Cassini Outreach, and I'm going to be your hostess today because we are having our semi-annual Project Science Review meeting where all of our Cassini science people get together and talk, and right now what they're doing is learning about the plans for our extended mission. And I think that would actually make a pretty interesting talk in the future. Our speaker today is Dave Doody. And Dave, besides being a good friend of mine, leads the team of Cassini Real-Time Mission Control Engineers. And these are the folks that work with the Deep Space Network and send commands to the spacecraft. They check the various types of data coming back from Saturn and initiate any needed responses to any kind of problems. Dave first published The Basics of Spaceflight, and that's the topic of his talk today, as a tutorial for the JPL operations folks in 1993. This is when he was working on the Magellan flight team. He makes updates to it frequently, and I actually have this linked to our Saturn Observation Campaign resources page because I think it's such a wonderful resource. He's working on updating it as we speak. And in his spare time, he teaches a public night course called Basics of Interplanetary Flight at the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California. He also can sometimes be found out on the sidewalks showing Saturn through telescopes. So he's just an all-around great guy. So with that introduction, I'm going to remind everybody that if you're on a speakerphone and you have some noise coming in that bothers you, you can be guaranteed that it's going to be coming across to all of us. So you can hit *6 to mute your telephones. Other than that, take it away, Dave.
Okay, thanks, Jane. Thank you very much. Hi, everybody. I think we'll be keeping this to under an hour, although there is more time available. And before I forget, I wanted to say thanks to Kirk Munsell and crew for getting the PowerPoint and materials available online. A few mechanics for today's talk. If you can use the PowerPoint, please do, because there are a couple of animated images that will make sense better if you can see them animating. And to do that, you'd use the PowerPoint file and bring it up in the view slideshow mode. Otherwise, we can talk around them. And in addition to that, I wanted to keep the content of movies in the PowerPoint show minimum, just to keep the file size down. But there's one movie that it will be really good if you can view while we're talking. And let me say in advance that movie is called out on slide 10 of the PowerPoint or also the PDF materials. There's a URL there that goes to the Soho site, and it's a movie taken from the Soho LASCO instrument. We'll talk more about what all that is, viewing the sun. And that's the one movie that I will want to have people look at in real time, if possible. Otherwise, we can still arm wave over the phone. Please interrupt. Let's keep it a casual conversation. Questions, comments, boos, hisses, at any time. Please just speak up, and we'll talk about your questions or comments. So the basics of spaceflight. If you're on the PowerPoint or PDF, let's go from page 1 to page 2, slide 2, where I've got the basics of spaceflight URL listed for future reference. Have any of you seen it already? The URL, the basics of spaceflight.
have, Dave.
Okay.
This is Jane.
Well, I guess it might take a little bit to mute and unmute, so I won't demand answers. But
I'll be sure to send it out to all the people who attend these meetings so that they all can bookmark it.
Okay, but it's spelled out here on slide two, www.jpl.nasa.gov/basics. And in this tutorial, it's divided up into three sections. Section one is the environment. Section two is flight projects, different spacecraft. Section three is operations, launch, cruise, encounter, and stuff. For today's session, just in the interest of time, I think I want to confine it to just two sections, our environment, where it is that we fly interplanetary missions, and a couple of different flight projects, maybe heavily slanted to Cassini, while not covering... Julie Webster gave a charm talk a while back, and so I'm not going to duplicate hers. But the tutorial online is broad in scope. It covers a lot of territory, but only at limited depth. And the intent is that we want to show the span of all the disciplines that are involved in interplanetary flight and the relations among those disciplines.
Excuse me a moment. I got called away. I don't see how you get the PowerPoint presentation. All that comes up for me is the PDF file.
Oh, there is a password-protected site. Jane, do you have the URL for that?
I sure do. Let's see. This was in the information that was sent out to announce this meeting, but
actually,
I will get
the email. But I don't see it on the website either.
Right, it was not in the email actually.
Not in the email, and it's not on the website.
I sent an email to Trina about this, but
she's been on vacation and in a meeting. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, let's take a minute and resolve.
Okay, I'm going to give everybody the URL, https://jplis-. Let me see, how much do I have to give you? Charm. Okay. JPLIS-STOR-CACHEO2.
CA what, please?
CACHEO2.
Okay.
.jpl.nasa.gov. It's long. That's why some of you, I guess, I don't know why you're not getting it. I know I sent it out to the Saturn Observation Campaign. Are some of you getting it from the Solar System Ambassadors or the museums?
Solar System Ambassadors. It was not listed there.
It
usually is.
Okay.
And to make it easier on people, I eventually found it by going to an old email.
Okay, great.
I'll
just remind Kay to put that in her announcements. But after jpl.nasa.gov, it's another slash and then doclib/. So https://jplis-STOR-CACHEO2.jplnasa.gov/doclib/. Now, when everybody gets there, you'll have a page that says Cassini Document Library, and you click on the library name Charm Documents. And you may be asked for the password and the username and the password. And if you are still with me, you type in the username is all lowercase, the word Cassini, CASSINI.
I came up NASA Space Store. Is that where I want to be? When I put all that in?
No.
Official NASA Space Store. That's what came up with all that stuff.
Hmm.
I have in http colon /JPLIS/store/cash02.jpl.nasa.gov. That's what came up.
Okay, then put in /DOCLIB slash. After NASA.gov /DOCLIB, document library, DOCLIB slash.
Didn't like the DOC doddering, oh, dash LIB?
DOCLIB.
Right, for some reason.
Jane, this is Ken in North Carolina. I think as I was overhearing, he might have typed out the word store in that first.
S-T-O-R,
right.
Not S-T-O-R-E.
Thank you.
Mute off.
Okay,
if you want me to send it to you, I can email it to you, whoever is the person
please.
Tell me your email address, and I'll be happy to.
I-G-N-E-L-Z-I.
A-R-T-H-U-R.
Excuse me, I'm starting over. R is in Ronald.
Okay.
I, let's start over.
Okay.
Qualified at.
Could you start over again?
Yeah, just start all over. The word qualified, Q-U-A-L-I-F-I-E-D.
Mm-hmm.
At S-A-N, as in San Diego, mm-hmm. .rr.com. Thank you.
Qualified at san.rr.com.
Correct.
Okay, I'll send
Here's
it right
another
in.
One for you, Jane.
Thank you.
Okay.
Am I up now?
No.
Okay.
Let me type this in. At... Jane, could you send that out to all the group? I only have the Saturn Observation Campaign names, and I send it out every month. So the people who get their announcements from the Solar System Ambassadors or the Museum Alliance, I don't have those. I don't know what the address is to send that. Thanks. Okay, next person.
R S C H M A L. L at wi.rr.com.
Okay.
Thank you.
And would you mind, you got to the username, but you never got the password for that other site.
Capital D O C dollar sign 85.
The D is the only capital, right?
Capital D, lowercase OC, dollar sign,
thank you.
85.
Could I please give you my mail address? Mute off. Hello?
Yes?
Could I give you my email address, please?
And can you tell me which list you didn't get it on?
No, I did not. Get it on the address that was given on the email I received.
Okay, great. Tell me your email address.
All right, it's an amateur radio call sign, K4CG.
K4C?
GS, that's correct. Charlie Golf Sierra.
K4CGS
at bellsouth.net.
Okay.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, I'm going to be sending this out. And so, Dave, why don't you go ahead, and then I'll see if I can find a way to send an email while you're talking to the other people.
Okay, that'd be great.
Take it away.
Okay, well, good. Thanks for the logistics. And this reminds me of flying missions before there was a World Wide Web and even before email. Back on Magellan, we made the transition. The early part of the Magellan mission, we had no email. And the latter part of the mission, we began to use emails. And then the World Wide Web came along in, 1992 or 3, 94 or so. Which is right about when we put the basics of spaceflight up on the web. It's one of the early websites. So, regarding the solar system, it's been... An interest of study from the beginning of prehistory, actually. All our human ancestors have been able to see the sky because Earth has periods, at least, and places where you can see through the atmosphere up to the sky, and you can see the stars and a few of those lights in the sky moving as the stars didn't move. They were termed wanderers or planets. But for all of human history, up until very recently, all our observations were based on visible light. And then in about 1931, we began accidentally to observe in radio. And then starting with the emergence of spaceflight in 1957 and 58, when the early Earth orbiters started flying, then we could get above the Earth's obscuring atmosphere and take advantage of not only light and radio, but the whole rest of the spectrum. And, you know, if you picture an electromagnetic spectrum, the visible portion is just a tiny little slice. And so opening up, observing solar system in particular in all of the electromagnetic spectrum is what we have available to us now. And then, on top of all that, with interplanetary travel, you can send instruments, of course, to many of the solar system objects to measure their properties up close, even directly in some cases. And in one case now, we've returned material, two cases, that's right, returned material back to Earth from out in the solar system. So let's go to slide 3. And today's session, we'll take a little bit closer look at the interplanetary environment that we operate in. And two, we'll see a little bit about some spacecraft and some instruments. I think since there are a lot of amateur astronomers, we'll look at some of the imaging instruments. And don't hesitate to come up with questions or comments. Page 4, slide 4, I have a cartoon developed by our Spitzer friends. The Spitzer is the infrared space telescope facility, which operates in orbit about the sun, trailing the Earth as the Earth and the telescope go around the sun. But it has marvelous views. And this is just an artist's depiction from the Spitzer people. And it's in four quadrants here, A, B, C, and D, showing the typical evolution of a star from the point where its cloud of interstellar gas and dust has flattened out into a disk. And from A to B to C is probably about 10 to maybe 100 million years, where the disk, rotating, of course, because all the infalling material didn't fall straight in. It had some component of motion to it, and that averaged out to a rotating disk. And, of course, formed a massive body in the center, which in the case of a star begins using atomic nuclei together and producing energy from nuclear fusion. And over the eons, the rotating disk and the force of the star's radiation in the center clears out the disk. And by the time you get to panel C and D, you've got a disk that's mostly a star in the middle, a bunch of big chunks or planets, and a cloud. And then in the final panel D is what our solar system looks like today. You can't even see the planets in the inner solar system in the nice print that I made, but basically a star and a bunch of debris left over. Now, in that D panel, if you imagine about a quarter of the way out from the central star, our sun, to towards the outer ring, and the outer ring is representing what in our solar system is the Kepler, the Kuiper belt of proto-comets, planetoids. About a quarter of the way out is about where Saturn would be, where we're operating our spacecraft. And I'd like to pause and think about the distances in terms of light time. Of course, light going out from the Sun to Saturn, since it's about 10 times as far as the Earth is from the Sun, it takes 10 times the length of time for light or radio signals to get out to Saturn. If light takes about 8.3 minutes to get to the Earth from the Sun, it takes 83 or so minutes to get out to the realm of Saturn. In my night school class last week, we used a large room, 205 feet long, a gigantic meeting room, to deploy a scale model of the solar system. And we had Saturn out at the edge of the room. The sun was about 2.4 inches in diameter on the other end of the room. And then I had a little crawler that crawls along the floor from the sun model at the scale speed of light. And, you know, you can say, okay, it takes 83 minutes for light to get out there. But when you're watching it go, when you're watching this little battery-powered crawler move at the scale speed of light, it really hits you that that's a long, long way. So by the time we finished walking around and discussing all the planets and their moons and things, the hour was up and the little speed of light indicator had only gotten halfway out to the Saturn model. Voyager. In this view, if we look at D as our solar system, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, which we're still communicating with regularly, are way out there in or past that outer disk. They're in the extreme far reaches of the solar system. And a signal at light speed to Voyager 1 these days takes 25 hours and change to get out to Voyager and back to see the results. So it's over 12 and a half hours one way, light time, out to where Voyager is. This Spitzer animation is available. I put a URL up there on the on slide number 4 if you would like to see this animating and rotating as a little movie. Now, of course, the main motion from the protoplanetary disk is still with us, the primordial motion of rotation around the central star. We never got rid of. We're still living with that. And so as we fly through the interplanetary media, that's what we are under the influence of. Slide 4 shows an actual image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, looking on to a star in the Taurus region of the sky, about 450 light years distant from the Sun. And we happen to be looking nearly edge on to a protoplanetary disk, where the star is forming in the middle. The disk is still thick and appears to us as a dark band. And above and below that dark band, you can see where the starlight is illuminating the rest of the debris, but there's that dark, opaque band where maybe planets are forming, maybe Kuiper belts are forming, and there are a couple of jets. And they say that, I'm not an expert in this, but from what I've read, jets going out from the disk where gas and dust are falling in to the embryonic star the jets emanate and carry energy and matter out many, many light years away from the star. Okay, I think if we go to slide 6, here's the results. In our own solar system, we have a central star that contains most of the mass from that cloud. 99.85% of the mass of that protoplanetary disk resulted in our central star. And since it's so massive, it has gravitation that just dominates the whole solar system, probably out to about a light year, where comet-like bodies in the outer Oort cloud, way, way out in the region near a light year from here, are moving so slowly that other stars can influence them. In fact, over the eons, as other stars pass the Oort cloud, they do disturb the orbits of bodies in the Oort cloud. And as we know, some of them fall in with perturbed orbits towards the sun. So mass and gravitation. Page 7, we have that primordial pre-existing dominating motion. And I put a picture of a carousel in there, horses on a carousel. If you use this analogy, if you're riding on a horse on the carousel, you can wave your arms, and you might even be brave enough to get up off of the horse and move around to different horses. But overall, you've got that primordial dominating motion going around the center. So even though we send spacecraft out around the different planets, we still deal with the primordial motion. Everything is basically orbiting the sun. If you want to get into the sun, it would take a great deal of energy to lose our motion. Okay, am I going too fast for people to chime in with any questions or comments?
Where are you going to find Dave?
On slide 8, I've added to the results, of course, the radiation from the central star, the sun. Heat, light, ultraviolet. In fact, throughout the whole spectrum, from radio waves through infrared, which we feel is heat, through light, red through violet light, more energetic ultraviolet light. And then X-rays and gamma rays do come from the sun, but they're mostly confined to the flares that come as disturbances in the sun's corona. Those are energetic in X-ray and gamma rays. So, lots of radiation. On page 9, there's more. The results of our protoplanetary disk having collapsed into a star. An extensive magnetic field. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are still sensing the magnetic field out where they are. And the solar wind and the occasional mass ejections from the solar corona. Now, the solar wind pours out. It was discovered in 1958, I believe, that the sun pours out plasma, that is, protons and electrons, hydrogen atoms that are electrically charged, the electrons stripped off of a hydrogen atom, and a few heavier atoms as well, but mostly it's protons and electrons streaming out a million miles an hour in the equatorial region of the sun. And you may recall a couple of decades ago, the Ulysses mission went into orbit in the polar region, around the polar region of the sun, and measured the solar wind not only in the equatorial plane, but also at the poles, and Ulysses found that the solar wind approximately doubles its speed up near the poles, the north and south pole of the sun. So here's this immense wind constantly streaming out of the sun, and there are occasional flares, storms, probably caused when magnetic fields do funny things in the corona to cause mass ejections. Now, the large particles and bodies in our solar system all obey Newton and Kepler as far as following their paths, orbits around the sun. But these microscopic particles, protons and electrons, even some dust particles that are charged, they don't care about Newton and Kepler. They just follow the magnetic field lines of the sun and also of planets that they encounter. Okay, let's look at the next slide, page 10. This is the movie that I invite you to have a look at in real time. It doesn't play within the PowerPoint show, but I did include the SOHO URL there. It's a long, complicated URL, but well worth it, I believe, if you wanted to copy and paste into a web browser. And you've probably seen these before anyway, if you're as interested as I am in the solar system. The SOHO spacecraft. SOHO stands for the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory spacecraft. Sits out at the L2 point, Lagrange point, where it's in a stable position between the Earth and Sun. It's very close to the Earth, but at a point where the Sun's gravitation balance is balanced by the Earth's gravitation. And so SOHO just sits there staring at the Sun. And this one instrument, LASCO, I forget what LASCO stands for, has an occulting disk that's visible in the image on page 10 as the dark blue circle in the center of the image. And you see a dark strut going from the center down to the lower left in this image. That's the strut that holds the occulting disk in front of the sun. So it's as though you're above the atmosphere, well, you are above the atmosphere, and it's as though you're watching a constant solar eclipse, watching the corona stream, solar wind particles and mass ejections outward from the sun. If you have the movie available, please go ahead and run it now. The white circle in the center represents about the diameter of the visible sun, and then you can see where the disk has blocked out the glare of the sun. But if you run the movie, you'll see the evidence of the solar winds streaming out. You'll see flares, coronal mass ejections coming off of the sun once in a while. This was taken, this series of images into a movie was taken in 2001 near the maximum of our solar activity period. About 3 seconds into the movie, you see a bunch of streaks, snow in the image, and that's where protons hit the camera, or the imaging device, a CCD, in the camera. And it causes short little white streaks as though you're suddenly in a blizzard for a couple of seconds. These coronal mass ejections, large ones, can eject a billion tons of matter at several million miles an hour out from the sun. So when you're flying in interplanetary space, you must have a spacecraft that will not be ruined by getting run into by a billion tons of coronal mass ejection several million miles an hour. And, of course, if you're a human traveling that distance in interplanetary space, you want to plan your flight to minimize your chances of getting any exposure to CMEs, coronal mass ejections. Okay, let's go to page 11, where we'll show a cartoon of the sun sending a coronal mass ejection out towards the Earth. Fortunately, the Earth has its own magnetic field that is strong enough to divert these charged particles away from direct impact with the Earth. And if that were not the case, if the Earth did not have a magnetic field, life, if any, would be very different on the Earth today. But the magnetic field sets up a barrier and routes the particles around. Some of the particles, of course, as you know, fall in through the magnetic field lines into the north and south polar regions of the Earth and other planets as well, producing aurora. I've never seen an aurora myself, but of course I've seen pictures. And aurora are caused where when electrons and sometimes protons are diverted down the magnetic field lines, and where they impact molecules of air, they cause them to glow. Mercury and Venus have no magnetic field to speak of, no planetary magnetic field like the Earth does. Mars does not have a planetary magnetic field. It does have patches on the surface that indicate there may have been a magnetic field, a planetary magnetic field in the past, but Mars has only got these fragmented magnetic, local magnetic fields. Jupiter, Saturn, all the Jovian planets, of course, have strong magnetic fields, and we can see aurora on them as well, especially if you look at those planets in the ultraviolet. Now, when a coronal mass ejection hits the Earth, the Earth's magnetic field, it causes it to fluctuate, and that can wreak havoc with the electric grid, even pipelines down here on Earth. Let's look at page 12.
Could I ask a question? This is Ken Kramer calling from Princeton.
Yep, please do, Ken.
I would like to, it's a beautiful shot, but what I'd like to know is New Horizons is the first spacecraft that's going to actually travel through one of these magneto tails. How is it that the Voyager spacecraft didn't? I guess it's trajectories, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Oh, gee, you know, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, that's a big point they're making.
New Horizons will be flying through the magneto tail of Jupiter?
On this flyby that's coming up in a month.
Oh, fortunate.
Yes, and it extends, you know, all the way out to Saturn. And I'm just curious why the Voyagers, for example, did not pass through the magneto tails of any of these.
Yeah, the Voyagers didn't because they were targeted only to fly their gravity assist trajectories, and that held them right in the ecliptic and, well, to a point, and along trajectories that just didn't happen to follow the field. However, when Cassini passed Saturn, we spent quite a bit of time going in and out of the magnetic field of, did I say Saturn? When it passed by Jupiter.
Jupiter, you mean, right?
Yeah, it passed by Jupiter on its way to Saturn. It dipped in and out of the magnetic field of Jupiter, while at the same time Galileo was orbiting deep within the magnetic field. So that gave for days or maybe several days or a week, I'm not sure what it was, Cassini did fly along in the boundary of Jupiter's. But then, of course, Cassini's trajectory wasn't designed to do that, so it dropped off that part of its opportunistic investigation. So New Horizons will spend more time in Jupiter's magnetic field. That'll be exciting for scientists who study magnetic fields. The next slide on page 12, it's not a very good image, I apologize, but what we're looking at is Edstone's sink. Edstone is the Voyager project scientist. He's been the Voyager project scientist for many, many years, since before launch of Voyager. And I guess he must be the happiest scientist in the world by now. But he studies magnetic fields, among other things, and the solar wind. And this view of his sink shows where water is coming down from an unseen faucet above and off to the left of the image, hitting the sink and spreading out. You know how a stream of water will hit a surface in a sink and then stream outward. But then it piles up, and you can see where the water is piling up here in this image. Well, this is analogous, and Ed Stone uses this as an analogy, to the solar wind. All those particles eventually slow down and bunch up. They go subsonic at some point out there. And it turns out that the point is right where Voyager 1 is. In fact, Voyager 1 is well beyond it now. Voyager 2 will be approaching this termination shock, as it's called, very soon, probably within the year, and should repeat the experience that Voyager 1 did. So Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 coming up are investigating the region here where the solar wind goes subsonic and bunches up, and then pretty soon beyond there, and we don't know how far yet, is where the sun's magnetic field ends and yields to the interstellar magnetic influences. Now, there's an animation of this. I have the URL there in the basics tutorial where it merges into a view, the animation that represents the solar wind. Well, everything has that primordial motion orbiting the sun, the center of the protoplanetary disk, and now the solar system. Page 13, let's take a quick look at orbits. This is on a cartoon on page 13, illustrates Isaac Newton's thought experiment that if Earth had a ridiculously high mountain, which it cannot, and you put a cannon up at the top of the mountain and fired the cannon, well, of course, the cannonball would hit the Earth, but it would follow an arc. And then his thought experiment goes, add more energy to the cannon, and the cannonball will go farther before it hits the Earth. And if you add still more energy, you can get your cannonball to miss the Earth entirely. Well, this thought experiment and the cartoon lends itself pretty well to defining terms for orbits about Earth, or orbits about the sun, or about anybody. Let's see, page 14, we have the term apoapsis. We'll call that mountain Mount Apoapsis, where apo is, I guess it's from the Greek, means the farthest point in an orbit. And imagine while you're at the high point in your orbit, adding more energy. Well, that takes you, let's look at slide 15, and if your PowerPoint show is running, this should show an animation, and you'll see that cannonball missing the Earth and going all the way around the Earth. Well, that completes Newton's thought experiment. But it also gives us the chance to look at the word periapsis. Apoapsis is the high point of an orbit, periapsis is the low point of an orbit. And I left out the intermediate stage where the cannonball goes halfway around the Earth and then impacts. And then you can imagine packing more energy into your cannon to lift that periapsis altitude up so that it misses the Earth entirely. Okay, on page 16, the animation should still be running and showing apoapsis and periapsis. The summary then, and this is really a key to interplanetary flight as well as orbital flight around an Earth. You added energy up there at apoapsis, and the effect was to increase the altitude at periapsis, and so your cannonball no longer hit the ground. Well, on page 17, the animation doesn't show this, but the notes, the opposite is also true. And you can imagine that as your cannonball is flying past periapsis, its closest approach, if you were to have energy added, say your cannonball or spacecraft had a rocket engine, where you could momentarily add some energy, just a burst of energy, tangent to your orbital direction, you could increase the altitude of apoapsis and avoid hitting that that annoying mountain as you come around. And that's basically how you fly planets through, fly a spacecraft among the planets in our solar system. On page 18, I blocked out the cartoon of the Earth with a cartoon of the Sun, illustrating that anything that orbits the Sun also has an apoapsis and a periapsis. Orbits are not exactly circular, except in rare cases. They're all ellipses. And on page 19, then, extrapolate that to a flight from Mars to Earth. And I'm not going to get into all the details because NAV is going to have one of these telcons. But if you notice the blue circle representing the orbit of Earth around the Sun, and here the objects are going back around the other way, reversed from the previous cartoons, and there's no animation here, this is just a still. You imagine a red orbit, saying, okay, this is the orbit that I would like to fly to get out to another planet, say Mars. So you realize that here on Earth, you are already at periapsis of the intended orbit. And so you just add a burst of energy, and that raises apoapsis, like we saw in the previous slide. And if you raise it enough, add enough energy, you get your apoapsis out to coincide with the orbit of Mars, for example. And if Mars happens to be there when your spacecraft gets there, then you can do stuff like slow down, get into orbit, or land there. So that red part, though, is called a transfer orbit, and I'm going to briefly touch on page 20. That orbit is called a Hohmann transfer, and I think we'll leave that as it is. I'm not going to dwell on this. Let's go to page 21. Well, you don't need to use fuel to change your orbit. Astronomers have known for a long time that comets traveling through the solar system have their orbits changed when they fly by a planet, for example, Jupiter. Spacecraft can do the same thing. This is proven in 1961 by a grad student here at JPL who did all the computer runs to show that verily a Voyager could use not just the gravity but the orbital momentum from the planets Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus to fly without any increase in propellant cost just about anywhere in the solar system. The simulator is a gadget that I produced under a grant from the Art Center College. On the Basics of Spaceflight website, there are instructions on how you can produce a crude version of one of these. And sometime in the near future, I promise this year, we'll have detailed instructions on making a better simulator that really drives home how a gravity assist works. Let me spend a minute on the image on page 21. In the middle is an orange ball that represents the Sun, and that sits on a heavy wheel that's made of granite. And on the wheel, you can see on the left, upper left part of the wheel, is a little circular magnet that's painted to look like Jupiter. And you have a mechanism that launches a steel bearing ball up across a glass surface. And you get this Jupiter wheel turning so that you can simulate the mass, the momentum of Jupiter going around the Sun. And it's true that the sun has most of the mass of the solar system, but the planets, Jupiter mostly, has all of the angular momentum in the solar system. I believe Jupiter and Saturn together contain about 90% of the angular momentum from that protoplanetary disk. The sun only has a small 2% or so left over. So Gravity Assist uses the momentum, a huge storehouse of momentum, by flying by, say, Jupiter at a close enough distance so that you get Jupiter's gravity to connect, make an elastic connection just briefly, and you actually slow down Jupiter a little bit with your spacecraft, just as when you fly a bearing ball past the rotating Jupiter magnet on the simulator toy, you slow down the rotation of the massive wheel. And that gives you a kick. Your BB gets flung out across the solar system, and if you're good enough at it, you can hit the Saturn target out on the simulator. And in the same way, Jupiter loses momentum to give your spacecraft a boost. Yes? Question?
I guess not.
Okay. Okay, and then the simulator drives home the point that you don't notice the momentum loss in the massive wheel, just as you don't notice the momentum loss of Jupiter when you use that momentum to boost your spacecraft. Page 22 shows the URL for a movie where Jane is demonstrating this thing. I'll leave that for you to browse if you like. Page 23. Well, maybe the most important result of the protoplanetary disk is, on page 24, planets, where we live, and stuff, moons of planets, comets, asteroids. If I were to pick a few of the moons of the planets to really study, I would pick Jupiter's Io, which is volcanic, Jupiter's Europa, which has a thin ice shell and a warm saltwater ocean. Saturn's Titan, of course, has a thick atmosphere, thicker than Earth's, and processes that are very similar to Earth's hydrologic cycle. There are methane rains on Titan. This has been the subject of previous telcons as well. And Enceladus. Enceladus at Saturn has constantly erupting geysers of water. Water particles may or may not have come from liquid water on the tiny little moon Enceladus. It's a real surprise. Page 25 is a nice backlit image of Saturn, where we realize that Saturn also has a disk of rotating material that you can use to study things like protoplanetary disks, galaxies, as well as other ring systems. And of course, every particle in Saturn's rings is a separate satellite orbiting the planet, interacting, of course, with one another. And this backlit image was the subject of a previous telcon. I'm not going to get too much in detail, but if you look at page 26, I do have a lot of detail available. This is a draft that's online on the Basics tutorial website, jplnasa.gov/basics. If you go to slant Saturn after Basics, you'll see the page that I'm working on. And it's not released yet. I don't have it linked in to the rest of the Basics tutorial yet. I'll do that after I've had enough peer review and corrected some wording here and there. But it's there if you'd like to browse it. The idea is that you go to that site and then you click on the image. It's halfway down the page on that website. And if you're using the right kind of web browser, it will let you see the whole image, and you'll have to scroll left and right and up and down to fly around in the Saturn system, as it were, and read all of the notes. And the notes point out all the various different effects of light and dark, shadow and forward scatter and back scatter. Well, there's no back scatter here in this. Yes, there is. But I invite you to have a look and send me comments, too, if you like. I'm working on this. There's also on that page, Basic Slant Saturn, a very large image of Saturn and the rings taken in forward scattered light, the normal viewing angles. And you can use your browser to fly around and look at all the different annotations. Let's look at page 27. There is also linked from that Basic Slant Saturn site an experiment showing the difference between backscattered light and forward scattered light, where the particles that you're looking at are close to the size of the wavelength of light. This is true at Saturn, particularly in the E ring, the F ring, and also within the Cassini division. So where you're looking at particles on the order of a micron, 1 to 10 microns, say, in backscattered light, that is, you are the observer on the same side as the source of illumination. And to show that in this image on the left, backscatter, I've got a laser in my hand on the same side as the camera, shining a light through cloudy water. And on the right, the laser is behind the cloudy water, shining towards the camera. And you can see that the cloudiness in the water, which is about 1 micron-sized particles, lights up like crazy. And that's analogous to how you're looking at the sunlight illuminating the tiny particles in Saturn system. And this applies throughout observations in the solar system. I used a few drops of homogenized milk in a jar of water, since the globules of homogenized milk are about a micron in size. Page 28.
Hey, Dave, this is Jane. Before you go on to page 28, I just wanted to mention to people who go to this page and go to Dave's images of the forward and backscatter, he has a link to the educational activity that you all can do in your classrooms or your museums or your events, recreating this activity. So the link to that activity is on that page.
Oh, good. Thanks. Well, page 28. My telescope is a 19-inch aperture, 7 3/4 inches. It's a Cassegrain, and it has a 1 megapixel CCD, but it's in orbit at Saturn. This is the narrow-angle camera on the Cassini spacecraft used for close-ups. The CCD, charge-coupled device, you probably have your own if you're an amateur astronomer. It's only 1 megapixel, 1,000 by 1,000 pixels. Not very impressive by Earth standards. Page 29 shows the wide-angle camera specs. Of course, Cassini and many other spacecraft are replete with instruments like these telescopes that view in the visible and plus and minus a little bit, and also instruments that view in ultraviolet, infrared, and far beyond. So this is just a tiny sampling. And all those other instruments as well are described on the Basics website. Page 30 is a crude illustration by analogy of how a CCD works. If you were to picture a million aluminum cans with their tops open, all bunched together tightly, you would have an analogy of a 1 megapixel CCD. And then picture it's raining over those aluminum cans. And then you have some way, after the rainstorm, of checking each of the cans for their content and measuring how much water collected in each of the cans. Well, a CCD uses tiny little solar cells, if you will, all bunched together, a million of them on a chip, in Cassini's case, that collects photons. In fact, it can register a single photon. A CCD is pretty sensitive. And so a CCD then is a charge-coupled device, is a means for gathering and counting how many photons have hit your detector. I'm going to cruise on up to page 31. If you go to the basics website, Slant Cassini, you will see an image of Cassini with all of the instruments and major components called out. And if you click on the names, it'll bring up a page that explains and gives specs for each of the instruments. Moving right along, on page 32, if you're using the PowerPoint show, you should see this animated. And it's a sine wave that represents the radio wave coming back from a distant spacecraft. The radio wave has the trace of a sine wave showing where the strength of the field increases and decreases and increases and decreases. In the case of, say, a Voyager, that's happening at the rate of about 2 or 3 thousand million times a second, 2 or 3 gigahertz. On Cassini, it's in the neighborhood of 8,000 megahertz. And in the animation, I have the wave seem to flash forward and back every once in a while. If you're not seeing the animation picture, if this standing wave in front of you were to jiggle 20% of the picture size off to the right and then quickly jiggle back. And that happens every once in a while. Well, that's how we send data from a spacecraft to the Earth in telemetry and command. There are other forms of data, tracking data, which the navigator's presentation will probably address later in an upcoming telecon. But this for telemetry, that is, sending data back from the spacecraft, telemeter, measuring at a distance. How you send bits, ones and zeros, once you've broken down your image or other science data into ones and zeros, you then stream them back to Earth. And the symbols we use are jiggles in the phase of the wave, pretty much like you see in the animation on this slide. And it takes a number of jiggles to be recognized as a bit, a binary digit, a 1 or a 0. In the case of Cassini, the coding that we're using now, it takes 6 of those little phase wiggles to equate to 1 bit. And this same scheme is used, well, Voyager, I mentioned, uses it. And Voyager, way out at the edge of the solar system, can still communicate at the rate of 1,400 bits, ones or zeros, per second. Spitzer Space Telescope, nearer to Earth with great big antennas, can communicate up to 2.2 million bits per second. And Cassini, when we have the large aperture antennas scheduled on Earth, we use 165,901 bits per second, about 166K. And to get that rate, the phase of the radio signal has to wiggle about 10 million times per second. Page 33 mentions our friends, the Deep Space Network, apertures in the on the order of 70 meters in diameter, 34 meters in diameter, located at three different places around the Earth. The Goldstone Complex in California, the Madrid Complex in Spain, and the Canberra Complex in Australia. So as the Earth turns, any one of those complexes can see any given spacecraft. The latest Deep Space Network antennas are a neat design where they've got all the equipment down in the basement, and they use a system of mirrors and pipes to get the signal up and down between the big reflector antenna and the equipment in the basement. And on page 34, if you feel the need to spend a couple of rainy days cutting and gluing and pasting, you can download all the parts for free on the internet at JPL-NASA.gov slant scale models and build a Deep Space Network antenna and see exactly how it articulates and moves the signal from the antenna to the basement. Please check back with the basics. Look in on it every once in a while. I'm upgrading it in the order of once a month. And if you go to the editorial page, it'll show what chapters have been upgraded. And by all means, send me your questions. My email address is on page 35, with which I'll say thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a pleasure. And we still have time for any more discussion, I think.
Thanks a lot, Dave. So the great thing about Dave's talk here is that all the URLs and everything is right here so that you can, at your leisure, go in depth and visit some of these pages and some of these movies. Does anybody have any questions?
Yes, I have a question. This is Ken Kramer. So I just want to understand, your entire syllabus then pretty much is at this website?
Yes, that's right.
Oh, excellent. That's what I wanted to know.
And it's got lots of links.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So we can look at that and learn. And excellent. Thank you.
And comment, please.
Comment. Yeah, I definitely am going to comment on your Saturn annotated slide there. Why did you guys actually put...
Could the speaker give his name, please?
Yes, Ken Kramer.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I didn't recognize it, Ken.
Yeah, sure. Yes, in the picture on slide 26... Why have you guys put Saturn in forward scattered light there?
It's 26.
Right. Saturn's actually inlaid in the amongst the rings.
Oh, good. I'll take that as a comment and adjust the wording. Very good. Yeah, what we're seeing is the forward scattering around the edge of the atmosphere. You're right.
Okay.
The rings are shown in forward scattered, definitely. Good, thanks for that.
Yeah, this is Kevin Kosky. I've got a question about Enceladus.
Uh-huh.
Are you guessing on that, or do you know that that could be a saltwater ocean underneath?
Oh, Europa.
I'm sorry, yes, Europa.
Yeah, at Jupiter. Galileo studied Europa in depth. There's still a lot of interest to... the possibility of sending a Europa orbiter to learn for sure. But in the studies of Europa's gravity, Europa's magnetic field, it does indicate that there's something creating a magnetic field, and the likely candidate is salt water, currents flowing through salt water. And the density and size measurements all strongly suggest that there is a liquid water, salt water ocean. Now, you'd never be sure until you bore through the ice and dip your toes in it. But
right.
It's a very, very strong several lines of evidence. Not only Europa, but also Ganymede and Callisto have strong indications of subsurface water.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Less, though, at those moments, right?
Yes.
I have a quick question for Jane.
Sure. Who's this?
Ken. you mentioned the your email. I wonder if you could send us your email, please. I don't think it was included. If that's possible.
It's everywhere, all over the Saturn Observation Campaign website.
Okay.
And but I'll send it to you. I think most people already have it.
Okay.
And I'm just filling in for the Charm Talk this month.
Oh, okay. What I want to ask about the Saturn Observation Campaign website. I guess from this.
Lots of questions.
That's a great question. Okay. Well, these talks are brought to you each month by the Cassini mission to Saturn, and from our science project team is actually sort of the sponsor of these talks. And the Saturn Observation Campaign is, let's see, you're a member of the Solar System Ambassadors?
Yes.
It's similar to the Solar System Ambassadors, except that it's open to international participation, and it's just sponsored by the Cassini mission. So what we do in the Saturn Observation Campaign is encourage amateur and professional astronomers and non-astronomers, such as librarians or teachers, or others who have an interest in observing Saturn, to do that, to show the planet Saturn through their own telescopes or a telescope of a local club to their communities. And just like you Solar System Ambassadors report your events to Kay, the members of the Saturn Observation Campaign report their events to the Cassini mission. There's about 50 members of the Solar System Ambassadors who are currently members of the Saturn Observation Campaign. In fact, that's the model of the ambassadors was what was used about 4 years ago to start the Saturn Observation Campaign. So it's very similar. It's a little less formal. We don't have the same amount of you know, like the ethics training and some of the, we don't have badges or T-shirts or so forth, like the ambassadors do. But what we do is we all love Saturn and are wowed by the Cassini mission, and we go out and do talks about Cassini and about viewing Saturn.
Okay, well,
and to find out more information about it, you can just go to the main Cassini website. And there's a link right on there to the Saturn Observation Campaign. And what I'll do when Kay gets back from Egypt is I'll send out an email to all of the Solar System Ambassadors talking about it, because I have some really nice pages that people can use to find Saturn and have a lot of resources.
Yeah, I'd like to definitely sign up for this. I do a lot of Saturn events, and
mm-hmm.
I wasn't aware of this.
I'll be happy to send you some information.
Great.
About it.
You must have my email.
I'll send it to all the Solar System ambassadors.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks for that great question. That's a way to say, and now a word from our sponsor, the Cassini mission. So with that, does anybody else have any questions? And if not, I think we can end the talk. For those of you who want more information about the Cassini mission, you know the URL is saturn.jpl.nasa.gov. And I think with that, I'll thank Dave very much for his talk and say goodbye.
Thanks for participating.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jane.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. Excellent.
Thanks, Jane.
You're welcome.
This is Ken in North Carolina.
Hey, Ken.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great.
Good.
That was a wonderful talk. I sat there enraptured. I want to build me one of those simulators.
You know, Dave made all of the various scale models. When you go to that website, there's a Cassini model, and there's tons of other spacecraft models, and he's the guy.
I mean, the actual, like, to put in the museum with the ball and the magnet and everything. Yeah, I'm going to see about getting someone or making one of those for my science center.
Should be kind of cool. Because I'm always talking about gravity assist, you know. And are you there? Well, that was weird. Hello?
Ken, are you still